Good evening. I didn't know there was a wand. I'm really looking forward to receiving it. I just passed my probation period, so I'm assuming that's my probation gift, is the wand. I'm sure it's in the mail. That'll be really handy. I would also like to acknowledge the First Peoples of this land, and thank you, Lee, for doing a better job than I would have being a guest in this place. And thank you to St. James Cathedral and to Lee for the invitation to come here. I first toured this cathedral about a decade ago, and if you had told me that I would be doing a public lecture here 10 years later, I would have laughed so hard I'd still be laughing now, and we'd be doing one of those weird laughter yoga classes that they give in Vancouver. I've never done one, but I've heard they're funny. I do want to give a bit of a warning. There's no graphic content to my presentation, but I do talk about the Indian residential school system, and there are some archival images of schools and of children, and so I do want to be sensitive to who's in the room. And if at any point you would just like to excuse yourself, I won't be offended. I've had bishops walk out on me, and I've recovered. So please take care of yourself. This is meant to be a presentation that is hopeful, but in order to get there, we kind of need to review some things that are harder to hear. I also wanted to talk a little bit about my use of terminology. So when I talk about settler Canadians, I do use it in this presentation to describe people who are not Indigenous to the land now known as Canada, those whose forebears were immigrants to this land. And I use newcomers to describe those who were not born in Canada, but came here themselves out of many different contexts and for many different reasons. So, archivist to animator. I grew up in a denomination that loved the theology of predestination. They were really excited about that. And I'm still kind of recovering from that. So I feel like I'm predestined to have job titles that need long explanations. So I spent 12 years as the archivist for the Anglican Diocese of New Westminster and the Provincial Synod of BC and Yukon. So in that job, I collected, cared for, and made available the historical records of the church. So when you go through customs in the U.S., particularly when Homeland Security is asking you what your profession is, it's important to say archivist very clearly, because if they think you've said anarchist, you will spend a lot of time in the Detroit airport that you had not anticipated. So I stopped saying archivist and started saying historian because that seemed to relate better. So now I'm an animator. I have no idea how I would explain that to border security. I don't work for Disney. That's the first thing. So an animateur actually comes from the French word, and it means someone who leads and encourages participation in a particular activity, especially in a cultural or artistic activity. So I see myself as someone who is here to animate a conversation, to keep a conversation and a movement alive. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about the role, so you know kind of the position that I'm coming from. There are four main pieces to the role that I now have. The first is to create and encourage reconciliation contacts, teams, initiatives, and a network across the Canadian church and ecumenically as well. So I began this by emailing every diocesan bishop across the Anglican Church of Canada to see what's happening on the ground in their dioceses with reconciliation. And then we'll move outward to ecumenical partners and then local grassroots initiatives so that Anglicans in Canada can see who is doing what in their area and team up, because we know that we do things better together, and reinventing the wheel is fun but wastes time. The second is to monitor the church's response to the TRC 94 calls to action. So when the TRC finished its work as a commission, they left us with 94 calls to action to further reconciliation in Canada. So part of my role is to help the church stay accountable to those and to monitor how we're doing in responding to those calls. Third, receiving and responding to calls for solidarity and justice from Indigenous communities. So this could be a community that is facing resource extraction on their traditional territories, legislative justice, the murdered and missing Indigenous women. So when our church is called to stand with Indigenous people in Canada, it's part of my role to be the point person to respond to those calls. And finally, what I'm doing here tonight is creating educational opportunities for the church to engage on subjects pertaining to the historical and ongoing effects of colonization. And I would add to that ways to engage in reconciliation. So a bit about me. As Lee introduced me, I grew up on Treaty 4 territory in Manitoba. Very rural, kind of the middle of nowhere. I remember the first time I saw a traffic light. I was 10 years old, and I just thought, this is some sort of miracle. It really is quite rural. The photo in the top right is the road to my childhood home. I grew up between a large Métis settlement and the Tutnuwazabeg First Nation. The context of my upbringing was profoundly racist. So I included a photo of myself on my tricycle because it reminded me of the first time I ever registered hearing someone say the words dirty Indian. And that's what I grew up with. In 2015, I was adopted into the Grizzly Clan of the Inklakatma First Nation. So I bring you greetings. Whenever I speak, my adopted family back in BC smudge and pray for not just for me, but for the people in the room. So I bring you greetings from my Grizzly Clan father, Coyote Terry Alec, who's there. His wife, White Wolf Woman, Christine, my sisters, Rainey and Echo, and my nephews as well. So they bring their greetings. Terry is a residential school survivor and was one of the first survivors in Canada to take legal action against the government of Canada. So as I said, for 12 years, I was archivist in the Anglican Church. When most of the Indian residential schools closed, the records often went to Ottawa. In the case of St. George's Lytton, which is in the Cariboo region of British Columbia, the records when the school closed down were left behind and ended up in the archives where I was archivist. As far as I'm aware, we were the only religious archives in Canada to have a full set of student records. So in the top right-hand corner, you'll see what's called a quarterly return, and I've taken out the personal information of the students so that you can still see what it looks like. So the principals, on a quarterly basis, would report to the federal government the number of students they had, their student number, where they were from, sometimes some commentary on the student, and basically the principal received funding per student. So it was in their best interest to compile as full a record as possible of who was in the school and at what time. And that was the fullest record that we had through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the students who had attended St. George's. So for 12 years, I helped survivors prove attendance at St. George's for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And with only a handful of exceptions, all of those hundreds of students told me at least part, if not most, of their story of being incarcerated in the school. And I use the word incarcerated intentionally because it was certainly against their own will and often, if not always, against the will of their parents. This was a devastating process for me. In the book, Yours, Mine, and Ours, Chris Hiller writes about listening to Indigenous voices in order to be undone by listening to the other. I was undone by the hard truths from the records. I was particularly undone by the story of a young boy from St. George's, and I call him Michael. That's not his actual name. And Michael was 7 years old when he fell ill in St. George's. When his family found out that he had fallen ill, they wrote to the principal of the school. And so I was reviewing the file of correspondence that was going between the principal and the Indian agent of the area. So when they received the correspondence from the parents And the parents asked if the boy could come home. It was obvious that he was going to die, and they wanted him to die at home. And the principal and the Indian agent in the correspondence, you can trace their conversation while they argue about whether or not they should allow this request, because if they let him go, their funding would be affected. So they went back and forth, and in that time, Michael got sicker. And eventually, they wrote back to the family and said, no, he could not go home. So Michael died in the school and was buried in an unmarked grave on the playground. The family wrote again to the principal and the Indian agent and asked if the body could be exhumed and sent back to the community for a traditional burial. And again, the correspondence shows the Indian agent and the principal going back and forth. And in the end, they decided that if this family wanted the body of their 7-year-old son, they would have to pay the exhumation costs and the transport cost for his body, which they could not afford. I remember so clearly what the file looked like and what the pages smelled like. And I put it back in the box, I vomited in my garbage can, and then I picked out the next file. And file after file and box after box, I was confronted by the greatest human rights violation in our country's history. And what many, the TRC called a cultural genocide, but many, including myself, call a genocide. I broke. I completely broke. I have seen and heard and read things that I can never unsee, unhear, or unread. No one can ever tell me it wasn't that bad. In fact, I know for a fact that it was far, far worse. Healing for me came through the survivors. And I'll get to how embarrassed I was about that. They were the only ones who could truly understand what I was witnessing because they had experienced it directly. They held me, literally. They prayed with me. They smudged me. And we even laughed together, if you can believe it. They sat with me when I broke. I had a lot of guilt and shame to work through. Guilt that this country that I had always thought of as so great and so beloved, that I had loved always, had done this. Guilt that the church that I had converted into because I thought it was so great with justice had been involved in this. And of course, guilt about my own internalized racism, that which I had been taught and had ended up acting out of myself. This guilt morphed into shame, a crushing shame, and became even more intense due to the fact that the victims of the system that I am a part of, and in fact benefits me, were the ones helping me to heal. I represented the oppressor. How could I be worthy of the love and care of the oppressed? There were more hard realities that I had to face. Much as I would like it to be different, we live in a culture that treats people differently based on race. Settler people, especially the ones who look like me, my brothers tease me that I glow in the dark. I'm so white. They used to say to my parents, we don't need a nightlight. Melanie's head is in the room. Especially people who look like me benefit from this system. I benefit from this system. This is sometimes known as white privilege. Peggy McIntosh describes white privilege as unearned power conferred systematically. White privilege looks like me not being afraid of police officers. I assume that they are there to protect me, not to potentially search me, perhaps falsely accuse me based on how I look, or, God forbid, do harm to me. It looks like not having a problem renting an apartment when the owner has a look at me. It looks like the history and educational textbooks I grew up with being written overwhelmingly by people who look like me and celebrating the accomplishments of people who look like me. White privilege is greater access to power, be it financial, educational, institutional, even in the church, based on race. The thing about privilege that I had to learn is that it exists even when I don't feel like it. I have rarely in my life felt powerful or like the world was my oyster. So when I first heard about white privilege, I thought, well, that doesn't apply to me. I didn't grow up in a well-to-do family. My family was very troubled. There was abuse. Life was not easy. What I had to learn is that that didn't mean I was not and am not privileged. It's not something that's returnable based on the way my life ends up looking. It's not avoidable. And God knows it has nothing to do with my upstanding moral character. It's also not available to everyone. These realities, of course, are made even more complex when we take into account other factors such as gender, sexuality, physical and mental health and ability, age, and other factors. Adding these other factors is sometimes known as intersectionality, but the base remains the same. White privilege just is. This became very experientially clear to me when I first began to see how differently my sisters, Echo and Rainey, are treated, how different their lives have been than mine based on their race. Things that they did not have access to that I have access to, ways that they are treated and ways that I am treated by the same institutions, the same systems, and even some of the same people. The results of these realizations bathed me, nay, drowned me in guilt and shame. It both paralyzed me and made me act in really unhelpful ways.